and that was the cause of some trouble between the two men. Pitten said nothing about Bray. Everything I learned about the running dispute between the two men I learned from Bray. I used his cards. Bray told his stories in his own way. He suppressed his own actions and provocations. He reported only what Pitten did. And the effect of this was to turn Pitten, so well-dressed, so steady in the manor grounds, his gait so measured, the effect was to turn this man, who was a paragon in public, into a madman at home. Bray would say as he was driving me to the railway station, "Our friend has taken up building these days, drilling holes in the party wall at 3 o'clock in the morning. What do you think of that?" And so Bray would allow one to play for a while with this picture of Pitten as a madman with the electric drill, raging about his house at night, a Mr. Hyde, with a modern ray gun, yet somehow sobering up sufficiently to appear neatly at nine, a Dr. Jekyll of the manor grounds, at the white gate of the lawn. And it will be only at the end of the ride with Bray, or during the next ride, or the ride after that, that I would learn that Bray, for every kind of good reason, his passion for work, his self-reliance, his hatred of the idleness which was undoing the country, the unreliability of other people, for all these very good reasons Bray had been taking down or tuning motor-car engines in his paved yard until well after midnight. In Bray there was an element of perverseness. He knew that his paved and oil-stained yard and his half-taken-down motor-cars offended people. He knew that they were an especial offence to Pitten, who lived next door. He knew, too, that it was inappropriate, a noticeable disfigurement of the valley which he was anxious for his tourist passengers to see. But Bray, though he would have denied it or not found words for it, wished to offend Pitten's idea of correct behaviour and style. And there was the added reason that Bray felt he could do as he pleased with his ground and house, because they were his, and because he, unlike Pitten, and unlike nearly every working man he knew, was a free man. Freedom was important to Bray, and though he presented the car-hire business and the taking of people to the various terminals of the many airports, and the picking up from the airports of foreign children, though he presented this as a high skill, almost a vocation, equal to anybody else's, his vocation was really to be a free man, not to be what his father had been, a man in service, a servant. Service. A world dead and gone. But not to Bray. His childhood lay there, just as my childhood lay in the vanished world of sugarcane fields and huts and barefoot children, and ditches and hibiscus hedges and religious ceremonies which I accepted but didn't understand, and the beauty of the lighting of the lamps after the prayer in the evening, and the fear of the rum shops and the quarrels and fierce fights. Just as estate, labourers, gardeners called up special pictures for me, so Bray lived with pictures of the valley I could only dimly visualize. He spoke often of the past to me. He spoke of harvest time and children taking tea to their fathers in the fields, of shepherds and their huts on the downs, of labourers who were granted vast daily allowances of beer, of picturesque clusters of labourers' cottages now knocked down. So far from concealing his background, he always brought it up, to remind himself, and me, or whomever else he was talking to, of how far he had come. What had Bray's father been? He had said at first the head gardener, the top man of the legendary 16, and perhaps only someone like that would have had the privilege of buying his cottage at a very low price, but later he had also said that his father had been the butler, the chauffeur, and sometimes even the coachman. There were wagons in the sheds next to the antique ivy-covered granary. So it is possible that this claim that his father had been head of the legendary 16 was only Bray's way of putting down the arrogant Pitten. Whatever his father had done at the manor, Bray was proud of his father, did not reject him. But connected with the father's service at the manor was a memory that touched Bray himself, and still caused him pain. He began to tell me one day of the time he had gone to work at the manor during the holidays from the village school, now no longer existing as a school, existing only as a building, a cottage, a desirable dwelling. It was an important memory. It still caused him pain. He could talk about it to me because I was a stranger, because I could understand, and because I was interested. I had developed a lot since 1950, had learned how to talk, to inquire, and no longer, as on the SS Columbia, but in the Earl's Court boarding house, expected truth to leap out at me merely because I was a writer and sensitive. I had discovered in myself, always a stranger, a foreigner, a man who had left his island and community before maturity, before adult social experience, a deep interest in others, a wish to visualize the details and routine of their lives, to see the world through their eyes. And with this interest, there often came at some point a sense, almost a sixth sense, of what was uppermost in a person's thoughts. So Bray began to talk one day of his holiday service in the manor, but something then occurred, perhaps a stop at traffic lights, perhaps some altercation or exchange of greetings with another driver. And then the pain of the memory overcame Bray's wish to tell me his story, and the days he had spent as a servant in the manor remained secret. Perhaps it was his acquiescence in the role that caused him pain. Perhaps he saw it as an exploitation of his innocence, his childishness. Children, whose experience is so limited, readily accept an abused condition. Even his play can encourage a child to live with his abused situation, can encourage masochism in someone meant to be quite different. Thinking back to my own past, my own childhood, the only way we have of understanding another man's condition is through ourselves, our experiences and emotions, I found so many abuses I took for granted. I lived easily with the idea of poverty, the nakedness of children in the streets of the town and the roads of the country. I lived easily with the idea of the brutalizing of children by flogging, the ridiculing of the deformed, the different ideas of authority presented by our Hindu family, and then, above that, by the racial colonial system of our agricultural colony. No one is born a rebel. Rebellion is something we have to be trained in. And even with the encouragement of my father's rages, political rages, as well as rages about his family and his employers, there was much about our family life and attitudes and our island that I accepted, acceptances which later were to mortify me. The noblest impulse of all, the wish to be a writer, the wish that ruled my life, was the impulse that was the most imprisoning, the most insidious, and in some ways the most corrupting, because, refined by my half-English, half-education, and ceasing then to be a pure impulse, it had given me a false idea of the activity of the mind. The noblest impulse in that colonial setting had been the most hobbling. To be what I wanted to be, I had to cease to be or to grow out of what I was. To become a writer, it was necessary to shed many of the early ideas that went with the ambition and the concept my half-education had given me of the writer. So the past, for me, as colonial and writer, was full of shame and mortifications. Yet as a writer I could train myself to face them. Indeed, they became my subjects. Bray had no such training, no such need. The pre-war depression, the war, the post-war reforms, and boom, lay between him and his past. The further away he was taken from that past, the more the world changed, the more perhaps it pained him. Politically, he was a conservative. "You know me," he would say, "I'm a down-and-out Tory," running together downright and out-and-out. By that, being a conservative, he meant really that he worked for himself and was a free man, that he had less regard for people like Pitten, who lacked the will to be free and worked for other people, and that he had no regard at all for people who were parasites on the state and hated the idea of paying taxes to support these people. With this Toryism, however, and his hatred of the Labour Party and the Communist, there went a strong republicanism. He depended for his livelihood on people with money. He liked the odd ways of the rich and liked to talk about these ways. But at the same time he hated people who drove Rolls-Royces. He hated landowners, people with titles, the monarchy, and all people who didn't work for a living. He hated titled people and old families and people of inherited wealth in a way I wouldn't have thought possible for an English person until I read William Cobbett. There, in the prejudices and strong-headedness and radicalism of 150 years before, a radicalism fed by the French Revolution, which in the pages of Cobbett, in the living breakneck speed of his prose could still feel close, I found many of the attitudes of Bray. An empire had intervened, a great new tide of wealth and power, but the passions of Bray were, miraculously, like the passions still of a purely agricultural county, the passions connected with manors and big farms and dependent workers. Much of this, with Bray, was rooted in his own family connections with the manor, and with some still rankling humiliation connected with his holiday period in service there. Pitten, the gardener with the tied cottage, dressed carefully. He aimed at a kind of country gentleman style. Bray, the free man, wore a driver's peaked cap. He said, when we were some months into our business relationship, which had developed into something like a village acquaintance, that he wore the cap because it helped with the police. And he was right, as I saw on many occasions, especially at the airport. The police uniformed themselves, acknowledged the peaked cap, responded to it, and were easier in every way with this badge of a trade. He also said another time that he wore the cap to distinguish himself from the ordinary taxi drivers who spent so much time parked and idle and skylarking. But they, the taxi men, thought the peaked cap servile, mocked Bray for it as they criticised him for his low charges, seeing servility there as well. And that, Bray's servility and general old-fashionedness, was the reason why Bray, who, because he was punctual and reliable and fair, had built up a bigger clientele than he could single-handedly manage, that was the reason why Bray couldn't get a driver to work for him for any length of time. Bray asked too much of the drivers he employed. He wished them to work the hours he himself worked. He wished them to dress formally, even to wear a uniform. Bray himself didn't dress formally. He wore the peaked cap, but everything else he wore went counter to the suggestions, the implied deference of that cap. He wore a cardigan, mostly, very seldom a jacket. A cardigan can be unbuttoned or buttoned in many ways. It can suggest formality, casualness, indifference. It can suggest, as Bray often made it suggest, a man called away from fireside and slippers and television. And the peaked cap, it would be set at many different angles. It could express regard or disregard. Set correctly, that cap, together with a buttoned-up cardigan, could suggest not deference so much as a man handling himself with care, a self-respecting more than a respectful man. The cap helped Bray to assert himself, to pass opinions and judgments on people he came into contact with. It would have been harder for him without the cap. He would have had to find words, set his face in different ways. He would, as a result, have been constantly embattled, the car hire or taxi business being what it is. The peaked cap, with its many angles, together with the various ways of wearing the cardigan, enabled Bray to make and make clear a whole range of subtle judgments. In fact, for the very reason that he was reacting against the service manner of his father, Bray had the variable, fluid personality of the servant, the various accents, voices, expressions. Bray, unlike Pitten, had no model, and, depending on himself alone, he gave a distinct impression of oddity. And that variable, passionate personality of Bray's, that many-sided personality, was perhaps fundamentally unstable. He didn't serve the manor. There might have been some quarrel there, about which I knew nothing. The Phillipses never mentioned it, and the quarrel might have been before their time. Yet his resentment of Pitten was also partly the resentment of someone he felt to be an intruder. Because he, Bray, felt and claimed that he knew more about the manor and our landlord than Pitten ever could. Similar houses, improved agricultural cottages, and both with working men who, for all their differences and conflict, aimed at the same thing, dignity. So tensions surrounded Pitten both where he lived and where he worked, because at the manor Pitten returned or vented to the full, but on the Phillipses, Bray's resentment of him as an outsider and interloper. Pitten, in spite of his buttoned-up look and lack of words, had his way of passing on his feelings. And as much as the Phillipses might indicate to him that he didn't know, he could pass on to them that they were townies, newcomers in the manor. So these three sets of people, so physically close and all in different ways, in service, lived in a net of mutual resentment. An odd thing about them was how differently they dressed. Choice in dress, cheap versions of stylish clothes, was limited by what the shops in Salisbury offered. And though I soon got to know the shop or outfitters, where Pitten bought his country gentleman clothes, and they were not particularly cheap, and the sports shop, much cheaper, where the Phillipses bought their padded anoraks or zip-up pullovers, and though I couldn't help seeing the clothes as merchandise, not truly personal to the wearer, more as samples of a vast stock, and though the shops in Salisbury were so close to one another, yet this difference in their clothes was important to them all. And all these people were tough, or insensitive, or partly blind to their condition. They needed to be. Bray earned the freedom he was so proud of. He never turned a job down and worked prodigious hours. He had nothing like a connected private life and seldom had a full night's sleep. The Phillipses were tough. even Mrs. Phillips, nervous and liable to headaches, living as they did with nothing put by, and with the knowledge that at any moment they might have to leave and live elsewhere, with other people, other relationships, other conditions. And Pitten lived not only with the irritations of Bray and the Phillipses, but also with the knowledge that away from the vegetable garden all his labour, not voluntary like Jack's, but paid, his job, was in the wilderness of the manor grounds, repetitive brute labour, with hardly anyone to notice, like the clearing away of the dead leaves of autumn, pointless labour like the cleaning of the hidden garden, which had then been simply closed up again, labour in grounds awaiting a successor. His improved agricultural cottage, the garden shared, the manor grounds, this was his little run, a dreadful constriction if it was all he had. He needed the other idea that he had, the country gentleman idea. Unsupervised, without fixed hours, he might, without that other idea and the temperament it gave him, have become slacker, might have degenerated into a tramp, become a Jack without the zest, the true coarseness, the life. I had a taste of Pitten's temperament myself in my second summer. I had gone away, done some travelling, and come back almost at the end of the summer. I found that the grass around my cottage had not been cut at all in my absence. A mere fringe of ground around the cottage was technically mine to look after and keep in good heart. 5 minutes' work with the mower, no more, but this little area Pitten had scrupulously left alone, though it spoilt the appearance of the lawn. Mrs. Phillips said, "People are funny," as though at last I had been given an idea of what they had to put up with. She would have watched the grass and weeds grow during my absence. She would have waited with some pleasure for my reaction when I got back. I had no wish, though, to get drawn into the resentments and quarrels at the manor. When I saw Pitten in the grounds, I went to him and asked him to lend me his mower. He was abashed. He had set up a little quarrel, a little tension, and had done so for some weeks in the full sight of the Phillipses, and now, at what should have been the climax, quarrelling time, he was abashed. What he had done in the sight of the Phillipses, but he didn't know how to quarrel with me, a stranger. It was touching. He began to mumble some explanation, but then thought better of it. He went directly to the shed and brought out the mower and a tin with the fuel mixture. He was solicitous. He even gave me a rag to wipe the mower casing after I had filled the tank. When I was finished with the mowing, I took care to leave the mower and the fuel tin just outside the locked door of his garden shed, as though letting him know by this dumb show I hadn't been so careful before when I had used his mower that I wasn't taking him for granted. And he responded in a way I never expected. On the Thursday afternoon, he took my dustbin to the manor courtyard for the Friday morning dustbin collection. He lifted the filled metal bin by one handle only, using only one hand and not altering his gait or normal walking pace, a demonstration of his great strength, in spite of his age and paunch and apparent slowness. So we became friends, and on some afternoons of the late summer and early autumn, sunshine and shadow on the lawn, we worked together. He allowed me to help with the last cutting of the lawn. I always liked cutting the lawn, and I helped with the gathering of the leaves, a pleasant mid-afternoon activity for an hour or so, oddly serene, stacking the leaves into a roughly carpentered two-wheeled caged trolley, pushing that through the orchard and past the children's house to the refuge, removing the front of the trolley, tilting the trolley forward and then spreading out the leaves on the springy, slippery leaf hill. A few days before Christmas I went to Pitten's house to give him a bottle of whiskey. It was damp and cold, the road ran with wet. The beech trees and the sycamores, though without leaves now, still seemed to keep out the sun. Pitten's gate and the paved path to his front door were in better shape than Bray's. It was only when I was right at Pitten's door that I noticed how badly in need of paint the door and timber surround were, and that the front casement windows were half rotted. It was a long time before Pitten came to the door. Perhaps he had had to prepare, to dress. And there was an embarrassment about him, a tightening of his face, which let me know that he didn't like being caught in his house. The house was much poorer than I thought. The improved agricultural cottage of 60-odd years before, however sturdy its external appearance, was a little ragged and knocked about inside. The narrow hall was shiny with rubbing, hardly a recognisable colour. The small front room was scrappily furnished. Modest furniture, which, though old, still made one think of the shops where it had been bought. modest television and hi-fi, which again made one think of cheap shops, cheap unlined curtains. Only the photographs of Pitten and his wife together, younger, of Mrs. Pitten alone, 20 years before, a photograph with which she was clearly pleased, looking over her shoulder, a photograph of the sun. Only these photographs made the room, which had been Pitten's for so long, personal. The casement windows, as I could see more clearly from the inside, were warped. The room was draughty. Why hadn't Pitten done something about the decorations? I know what he would have said. Decorations were the estate's responsibility. The house wasn't his. He was waiting for the estate to decorate his front room and no doubt the rest of his house. He was content to allow time, a portion of his life, to pass in drabness. It was disappointing. Here was the true servility, the true obedience of the man. It was hard, faced with his gravity, his measured movements, his weighty manner, his self-cherishing, to grasp that other fact about him. So much of the money he earned, then, went on clothes for himself and Mrs. Pitten, that show to the outside world about which they were both so particular. I gave him the whiskey. He thanked me, but he didn't look especially pleased. His tight expression didn't go or soften. That expression softened. The muscles of his face grew slacker only when, making conversation, covering up what I now recognized to be the error of my visit, I mentioned his hi-fi equipment. I said I had nothing like that myself. The tight, embarrassed look on Pitten's face was replaced by a foolish, self-satisfied smile. He was glad, it was amazing, he was glad his possessions had surprised me. And that foolish smile of Pitten's took me back to early childhood, like a dream here, in this valley, in this house of Pitten's, and to painful memories. Within our extended family, our little unit was poor, and I remembered on the one or two occasions when remote, richer branches came to visit us, how strong the instinct with us was to boast, to show off, to pretend that we were richer than we were letting on. Curious instinct. We didn't boast with people who were as poor as ourselves. We boasted to people who were richer, who could easily see through our vanity. I had seen it in others, too. My earliest observations as a child were about the lies of poverty, the lies that poverty forced on people. We were a very poor agricultural colony at the end of a great world depression. Very few people had money. Great estates had to be sold for very little, money being so scarce, and among the labourers there was great distress. Yet as a child I saw people pretending to their employers, to the people who paid them every week, that they, the paid people, were richer than the payer knew, that they, the daily or the weekly paid, people who worked for 8 hours or more a day, for less than a dollar a day, had secret means and, almost, a whole secret life. Something of this, some whiff of huts and damp and the swamplands of my childhood, came to me at Christmas, in the Wiltshire Valley, in Pitten's improved agricultural cottage. He was poor. I discovered now that he was hurt by his poverty, ashamed of it. I discovered now that his nerves were rawer than those of the Phillipses or Bray. He was much more vulnerable than they were. The shout of, "Fred!" came from somewhere in the manor at about 3 o'clock. It had taken me a little time to work out that that was being shouted, the shout having at first seemed like another of the many country noises, the cry of some animal, the far-off cuckoo-like shout of the cowman driving the cows back from the water meadows to the milking shed. He was simply shouting, "Go on, go on!" Farm machines, birds, the flap of pigeons' wings as they fluttered about their perches or roosting places in the thick ivy on the old granary wall, the antiquated milking machine from the farm beyond the churchyard. This machine rose to a scream just before it was turned off, making you aware, then, in the comparative silence, of the whine with which you had been living for the previous 2 hours, a whine which lingered like a ringing in the ears, or like the sound of cicadas, the drone and roar of military aircraft. When I had worked it out, the shout of "Fred!" from Mr. Phillips became quite distinct, and I thought it was part of an old routine, something that had existed long before my time. I soon discovered that it wasn't so, and I was able to give a character and mood to the shout, and to understand the tensions that played around it. Pitten, I then realized, never acknowledged the shout, or called back. It was an afternoon shout. But sometimes, and especially in the spring, it could be heard in the morning. It meant then that Mr. Phillips was mediating between my landlord and Pitten. In the spring my landlord wanted to see flowers, to go shopping, sometimes to combine the two things. He didn't want to visit other gardens. That would have been too disturbing to him, entering other people's houses or territory. He preferred to go to flower shops and garden centres, and he wanted Pitten to go with him. On these excursions, when Pitten was called away, where did he sit in the manor car? Did he sit in the front, beside Mr. Phillips, the other manor servant, or did he sit alone in the back, a man apart in another way? I feel Pitten was taken along for the company and the protection his company, together with the company of Mr. Phillips, offered my landlord. Pitten couldn't have been taken along purely for his advice as a gardener, because the plants bought, which Pitten had to look after, were not always suitable. Azaleas, I remember once, unsuited to our chalk, which Pitten had to plant more or less in pots of sand. I asked him why, and he floundered, became inarticulate, until inspiration came to him and lit up his face, and he said, "Minerals!" Having planted the azaleas in sand, he had then every day until the azaleas died to feed them with an expensive iron solution. Feeding being quite an appropriate word, for these small azaleas needed to be fed with droppers, the way birds or young motherless animals might have been fed. In my third year, my third spring, there were more of these morning shouts than before, and this had to do with a change in my landlord's condition. From being very ill and almost immobile with his acedia, but about the time the Phillipses had gone to the manor to look after him and his house, my landlord was beginning slowly to recover. Some medicine or drug had been found to neutralize the paralyzing nature of his acedia, and this brought into play again the personality, or that part of it, that had survived his long withdrawal and blankness. An operation had then partially restored his sight. In this reawakening of my landlord to life and his especial world, the Phillipses helped a great deal. Mr. Phillips was professional, understanding, a protector, a strong man to whom the sick man, at once employer and dependent, could entrust himself. To the strength of her husband, Mrs. Phillips added tenderness and admiration for the artistic side of the employer, who wrote poetry and now, in addition with his restored sight, began to do drawings. These drawings were oddly fluent, practiced, easy, as though they had been done many times before, as though they came from a segment of that past life of my landlord's that he had just recovered, Beardsley-like drawings of another age, with long tendril-like lines and little stippled areas emphasizing the large areas of white. Some of these drawings, in reproduction, his continuing or reawakened extravagance, he sent me by Mrs. Phillips now, in place of the old printed sheets of poetry he had sent in my first year. In his reawakening, his rebirth, my landlord met the Phillipses halfway. He was tender with them, as they reported. They were part of the life he thought he had said goodbye to. The Phillipses accordingly felt needed. Perhaps in none of their previous jobs had they been made to feel like that, and they in their turn became softer, less spiky, more secure in their positions in the manor. Their toughness was now partly explained. It was the toughness of people who wanted to be as tough as they had found the world tough, and wished to hold themselves ready for whatever fortune threw at them. The Phillipses, becoming confident in the manor, no longer strangers to the place, became happier, as happy in their way as their employer in the summer. That repeated morning shout of, "Fred!" seemed to say it all. As did that glimpse of a happier Mr. Phillips, like an impresario, driving with his employer that day in the manor car, on the road below the old beeches. That mood lasted into the next summer. Pitten often had to go away on some excursion, and sometimes when he came back, he had some little piece of news for me. "I've hardly done anything today. I was called away early this morning." He wasn't complaining. He liked the idea of being called away. He was recording his pleasure at the new idleness, the new closeness to his employer. And with that closeness, the sudden luxury almost of his job. Car rides, shopping trips, sightseeing trips, all on a workday morning. He said, "Pitten." That's how he calls me, you know. He doesn't call me Mr. Pitten. I called him Mr. Pitten. That was why he gave this explanation. "Pitten, I think we should go to Woolworths this morning. I hear they have a good garden department.
Woolworths,
Pitten said, amused but respectful. Imagine him in Woolworths. Of these summer excursions of my landlord, I heard second accounts from Mr. Phillips sometimes, and of some of these excursions I had even a third account. This came from Alan, a literary man from London, a distant relation of my landlord, who sometimes came now to spend a weekend at the manor, which he had known, he said, from visits as a child, beginning with the war. Alan was in his late 30s. He was a small man, as small as I was. His size was one of the things that tormented him. He told me almost as soon as we met, as though to raise the subject before I did, that at school someone, one of the teachers, I believe, had referred to him as dwarfish. This worry about his physical appearance perhaps explained Alan's clowning, his mighty explosions of laughter, the extravagant cut and colours and shininess of the clothes he wore at parties in London, where from time to time I saw him. The gaiety of these clothes and the boisterousness of his manner contrasted with the nervousness, almost the shiftiness, of his eyes, and contrasted as well with the solitude and soberness of dress and behaviour he imposed on himself when he visited the manor, where one sometimes surprised a wrinkled old lady's look on his face before the wrinkles became the wrinkles of gaiety. Alan seemed to spend much time alone when he was at the manor. He was to be seen at odd hours, wandering about the grounds, carefully dressed, and usually in country clothes. But there was no audience there for his clothes or his moods. What did he get out of these visits? He said he liked the house, the atmosphere, and he was fascinated by my landlord, whom he found very period. The period, as Alan said, before the deluge. Antediluvian. He had heard from my landlord about the trip with Pitten to Woolworths. When he told me this, he roared with laughter. He said that Pitten was too ashamed to enter, and had absolutely to be dragged in. Who had improved the story I had had from Pitten? The story in which Pitten had been simply amused by the trip to the garden department of Woolworths? Was it my landlord, the reawakened recluse, or was it Alan? Alan had no book to his name. He wrote occasional book reviews and did occasional reviews of books and films and other cultural events for the radio. His radio work was better than his printed work, his voice and speech suggesting and transmitting a greater intelligence and zest. Such a slight name, though, such a slight achievement for someone nearly 40, someone who had already more or less defined his personality and path and the level of his ambitions. On the radio, his voice and attack and wit suggested that those few minutes in the studio were the merest interlude in a busy, complete, rounded life, a life one might envy. Listening to him, one felt that there was so much there in the man, the sensibility, the cultivation, the mind. There was so much more that he would have said if he'd had the time. That was also the impression, though to a fainter degree, that his printed work gave. The few paragraphs one read appeared to be just a shaving from a larger, more considered view of life and art and history, and even from a more considered view of the book or play being written about. But those little reviews and short radio talks and swift discussions, abruptly terminated by a chairman before the news program came on, that was the sum of Alan's work, life. He did no other job. To know his name, to mention some slight thing he had done, did not, as one might have expected from someone so urbane, get an abashed dismissal from him. It encouraged him to speak of his work. He remembered all the phrases he had made, phrases that had seemed on the radio to bubble out of a natural effervescence, and sometimes fell a little flat in print. He would say, "As I said in that review of the book about Montgomery, the writer seemed to have been dropped on the head as a baby by a military man." And he would break off and roar at his own joke, just as he roared at the joke, his own or my landlord's, about Pitten going ashamed and cringing outside the doors of Woolworths and having to be led in firmly by the long-haired recluse. "Isn't it nice to have rich friends?" Alan said one weekend, and feeling he had said something frank and funny, he fluttered his eyelashes, and the coquettishness, quite unexpected, revealed another side of his dissatisfaction and incompleteness. Alan, speaking of rich friends, was thinking more of himself as a writer, the man with patrons and grand houses at his disposal. But we were all embraced that summer, made light-headed by my landlord's reawakened sense of the luxurious. his reawakened extravagance, his constant wish to seize and heighten the passing moment, to arrest and elaborate on every experience. These were the manners and style, as Alan said, as though to explain his point, of before the deluge. Now Mrs. Phillips brought to my cottage new printed drawings, a shopping basket, flowers, elegant gifts which I found difficult to acknowledge, for the man and the nature of his gifts seemed to require a matching light elegance, and I found myself in my letters to him straining for effect, trying to make myself worthy of his generosity, trying to give myself a sensibility equivalent to his own. One sunny morning, about coffee time, I saw Pitten standing outside the overgrown box-boarded enclosure at the side of the lawn. The enclosure once attached to the house that, as I had heard from Bray, had stood on the site formerly, and possibly had older religious antecedents. The weeds in the enclosure had grown tall, stalky with fine white flowers, but Pitten had cut his annual path through the weeds to the orchard, one swath up, one swath down. The path had been cut low, revealing level, tightly knitted grass, the grass in one swath lying at a contrary angle to the grass in the other, the two swaths showing as two distinct colours, one green, one almost grey. And Pitten now, in the middle of the morning, was standing on the lawn just outside the enclosure, standing still, looking down at the grass. The overgrown box trees made an arch above the entrance to the enclosure. Pitten was framed in this wild green arch. Behind him was the two-swathed path between the tall, white-flowered weeds, like a passage in a maze. He was leaning forward, looking fixedly down, legs oddly apart, as though he were standing on sloping or uneven ground. His woolen tie, winter and summer, Pitten wore a tie, hung straight down. His tie didn't rest on his paunch. He reminded me of a man I had seen 13 years before, a forest Indian in a new mission settlement in the Guyana Highlands in South America. The settlement was on the bank of a river, not one of the great continental rivers, but a narrow river of these highlands with big boulders on the banks, and big smooth boulders, sometimes neatly cracked, in the riverbed itself. It was a Sunday morning, and the Indian was dressed as formally as Pitten was now dressed. The Indian was in blue serge trousers and a white shirt. He had gone to the Sunday morning service in the mission chapel. The settlement was in a new clearing. The stumps of felled trees still looked raw. The forest still pressed on three sides. And now, after that morning service, the Indian was on his way back to his forest village, taking the path at the edge of the clearing, just above the river, which in sunlight was the colour of pale wine, and at dusk became black. Night, here, made for anxiety. Daylight was always reassuring. Something on the path had caught the man's attention, had alarmed him, and he had stopped to consider what he had seen, the thing that didn't belong to the path, a twig, perhaps, a leaf, a flower, and perhaps hinted at a terrible danger. For the Indians here there was no such thing as natural death. There was a killer abroad always, the Canaima, a man like any other in appearance, never known or suspected to be the killer, and he it was who eventually killed everybody. Stock still, then, the Indian on his way back from the chapel stood on the path above the river in the morning sunlight, in his blue trousers and white shirt, wondering whether, in spite of what the missionaries had told him and his fellows, the thing he had just seen on the path wasn't a sign that the Canaima, who got everyone in the end, hadn't finally come for him. It was a narrow path between big sunken boulders. The Indian didn't make room for me when I got to him. I walked around him. He didn't look at me. It was with a similar stance and abstraction that Pitten stood outside the overgrown enclosure, but he knew he had caught my attention, and he was waiting for me to go to him. When I was almost upon him, he lifted and slowly swung his left leg so that he stood upright. A stiff, deliberate movement. It might have been a wooden leg, but the face Pitten lifted to me was alight with passion. I had never seen him so stirred. His eyes were bright, moist, staring. His nostrils were quivering. He was full of news, bursting with news. He said, "I've been drinking champagne. He called me to his garden and gave me champagne." And more than the wine had made Pitten muzzy. It was the sunlight, the occasion, the luxury, the hour of the morning, the unexpected development of this bewildering summer, play piling upon play. If I hadn't come upon him, he would, I feel, have gone home to share his news with his wife. he said again, getting muzzier by the minute, contemplating the moment, eyes almost wild. Champagne! I heard another version of this event about a month later from Alan. The summer was over, more or less. Alan was wandering about the grounds in a Matelot outfit, like a sailor figure of one of the earliest poems my landlord had sent me in my first summer, after the poems about Shiva and Krishna. Alan said, "He's in great antediluvian form. I hear he's been feeding Pitten pink champagne." And the idea so amused Alan that the full laugh he started on began to choke him. Recovering, he said, "Pink champagne at 10 o'clock in the morning." He told me that Pitten was absolutely slain, absolutely slain. And I felt now that that other story, about Woolworths, hadn't been improved on by Alan, but by my landlord. He had stored up the story of Pitten and the champagne, as Pitten himself, and Pitten's wife, no doubt, had stored it up. He had stored it up to tell it to visitors like Alan, people who knew and cherished his reputation as a man with a style of before the deluge. Yet the impulse that morning, the need to celebrate the moment, would have been genuine. Later would have come the ideas he had of his own romance. Later would have come his wish to make the story, to tell the tale, to spread his legend. After the long, morbid withdrawal, the near death of a soul, he had revived. But what had also revived was the idea of who he was. That was shown in the disproportionately large and thickly lettered signature on his new drawings. It was even bigger than the signature on the printed poems he had sent me about Shiva and Krishna, while he was still very low, pressed down into himself. The personality that had survived its illness now had a smaller area for play. It was also a smaller personality. It could play only with people like Alan. There were not many like Alan, not many who knew his, my landlord's, legend now. And Pitten. "Isn't it nice to have rich friends?" Alan had said. But that was Alan's own fantasy. That was the vision he preferred to have of the place where he came to stay. The Phillipses knew better. They knew how many things at the manor needed to be done. They knew how little could be done. The manor had been created at the zenith of imperial power and wealth, a period of high, even extravagant, middle-class domestic architecture. The extravagance of houses like the manor lay partly in the elaborateness of the modern systems, plumbing, heating, lighting, that had been built into them at the time of the building. Whatever their architectural style or whimsies, and though in certain particulars, thatched roof, use of flintstones, they might aim at local, rustic effects, houses like the manor were a little like steamships. They had been built with that confidence, not just the confidence of wealth, but also the confidence of architects and technicians in the systems they were putting in. And it was that industrial or technical confidence, the confidence which in other manifestations had created the wealth that had built the manor, that now made the manor an expensive place to look after. The manor had been built like a steamship, but like a steamship it was liable to break down and obsolescence. A boiler exploded in the manor one day, another time a bit of the roof was blown off. Each accident would have cost thousands. The plumbing and drainage systems were obsolete. When late at night water was used in some quantity at the manor and the cistern there began to fill again, the metal pipes in my cottage hummed in the dead silence. During the day that humming noise was masked by other sounds. The metal pipes that had been buried in my cottage walls, such had been the confidence of the original builders in their materials and systems, had also built in such damp in the walls that the pipes were shadowed on the surface of the walls by lines or tracks of grey-black mould, which was like the fur a rat leaves in its nest or hiding place. 70 years and more of rain, rolling chalk and flint and mud off the downs, had clogged the drains in some places. The lawn was not the simple level ground it seemed. It concealed Edwardian drainage pipes, which were now broken underground, no one knew exactly where. In the winter of the great flood, a small hole like a rabbit hole suddenly opened in the lawn during a morning of heavy rain. The hole seemed to cave in on itself, melt into itself, and then out of that melting hole, a brown torrent, at first looking only like a kind of animal activity, a mole kicking up earth very fast, gushed for half an hour. From time to time we had a visit from the agent. This was a reminder that we were not exempt from the world where others lived, that there was a practical side to affairs, earnings, accounts, a need to balance income and expenditure. It was from the Phillipses that in the beginning I first heard of these visits. In those days, before the Phillipses had become confident, they appeared to look upon these visits by the agent as inspections, and they prepared accordingly. They didn't overdo the zeal, but it was possible, from a certain amount of activity in the manor courtyard, and sometimes even from hints dropped to me about the drift of leaves against my north wall, impossible absolutely to clear, that wall was the natural resting place of beech leaves for 200 or 300 yards around. It was possible to tell that a visit from the agent was expected. But then the agent often turned out to be a very young man, a junior, someone fresh from school or college, someone who had just joined the firm and was using our estate to cut his teeth in the land agenting business. Agents here handled mile upon mile of fishing rights, beat upon beat, thousands of acres of farmland, thousands of acres of woodland. Our few acres of wasteland, virtually untilled, though a world to us, offered no land agent a challenge or even a training. And it often happened that the young men who came, moving on quickly to higher or bigger things within their firm or another firm, never came again. It was hardly worthwhile, therefore, cultivating them or even getting to know their names. And from looking upon the visits of the agent as inspections, we began, or at any rate the Phillipses began, to look upon them as occasions to ask for things, repairs here, a lick of paint there. And from making ourselves spruce to attract commendations, which might be reported at a higher level somewhere far away, we sought to look as ragged as we could. After that wonderful summer of the motor car drives, and the flowers and the champagne, we began to get very ragged indeed. Three of the beeches at the edge of the lawn were judged to be dangerous, liable to fall into the manor courtyard, and within a week they were cut down and their branches cut up and corded, some stacked in one of the outbuildings, some carted away by the tree-cutters as part of their fee. So all at once, within a week, I lost some of the green shade, the green gloom, by which I had felt embraced whenever I returned to the manor from any journey, however short or long. Only the yews and beeches at the front of the house separated me from the road, and though the beech trees, big as they were not really a form of sound protection, I fancied after those three beeches went that the road noises were louder, especially after five, so that, for the first time here, I became aware of the end-of-day traffic, and I fancied I heard the military airplanes more clearly, too. How fragile my little world was here. Just leaves and branches. Just leaves and branches created the colours and the enclosure I lived within. Remove them, a morning's work with a chainsaw, and the public road would be just there, less than 100 yards away, and all would be open and exposed. How often, with Pitten's mower, I had cut the thin, pale green straggly grass under those beeches, going right up to the end of the lawn, next to the overgrown yews, going right up to where the ground was not grass or lawn so much as old twigs and beech mast, and old, light-starved dust. It was never satisfying to use the mower there, but it was necessary because it completed the job, gave the complete, swept, cared-for effect all over, so that for a day or two after a grass cutting it was a pleasure for me to look at what I had done, the swaths I had created myself in rich grass and poor grass, from end to end of the lawn. Now, in the openness after the three beeches had been felled, grass began even in the autumn to appear on that twiggy, dusty soil. And all that winter and spring, until the grass began truly to grow again, there remained, quite literally, impressions of the felled beeches on the lawn. The tree fellers had made them fall at a particular angle, so that in the new openness, the new light around the manor courtyard, the beeches, though they had ceased to exist, seemed for half a year to cast ghostly shadows. The decision to cut the beeches was a prudent one. The gales were severer than usual in the spring, so severe that I stood in my cottage kitchen to watch, through a low window, the effect on the beeches in front and, through the glass at the top of my kitchen door, the trees at the back. It was strange, but for myself in my cottage I never ever feared, and I actually saw the two great aspens at the back of the manor garden snap, twice, a tearing off near the top, and then a fierce, short, snapping back lower down, so that, understanding the principle of the damage, it was a little like watching a human or animal limb break. I hadn't planted those trees, but I saw them destroyed. In the spring and summer, the three aspens, planted perhaps 10 feet apart, had created the effect of a great green twinkling fan above the garden wall. Now two of the three aspens had been snapped like twigs and showed, but on a magnified scale, that sort of twig-snapped damage, and their debris lay between the water meadow and the vegetable garden wall, just beyond the briar wilderness of the old rose bed. It needed more than Pitten and his hand saw to clear the mess. I tried to help him, but even when we worked on a smallish bough, there always came a moment when the saw stuck in the wet, sappy wood and became very hot. Pitten would say, "It's tying. We'd better stop." "Tying, Mr. Pitten?" I liked the word. I had never heard it before, but it was suggestive and felt right. Pitten became embarrassed as he had been when I had asked him what was in the sand that was good for the azaleas he had been asked to plant, as embarrassed as he had been when he told me my landlord had liked the peonies, rhyming with ponies, in front of my cottage, and, while feeling constrained to use the affected Edwardian pronunciation of my landlord, had wished at the same time to show, without disrespect or disloyalty, that he also knew the other, more common and correct pronunciation. The fallen trees were a great obstruction now if I wanted to go on the river walk. The jagged white wood of the aspen stumps, 15 or 20 feet high, slowly lost its rawness. With the spring and summer there were even new shoots. The planter or the designer of the garden would have carried in his or her mind's eye the fan effect the three trees were intended to have when the seedlings or saplings had been planted 10 feet apart. Far apart, they would have seemed then, and for the next 5 years or so, but still too close together, as it turned out. The trees at the sides, as they had grown, had leaned away from the vertical. The fan effect had been seen by me. I had seen the three trees grow by many feet every year. I had also seen what the planter of the garden would not have cared to think about, the very second, not longer, when the two side trees snapped. The trees would have spanned or been contained within my landlord's life. He must have seen that two of the aspens were no longer there. He must have seen the mighty debris in the back garden. But I had no word from Mr. or Mrs. Phillips that my landlord had seen or made any comment. It seemed suitable, so ragged had we become since the autumn, that in the early summer we should have had a visit one day, in mid-morning, not from one, but two men from the agents, and this time not just the standard very young men. There was one of those, but with him there was an older man, a taller, heavier man in his late 40s or early 50s. I saw the two men on the lawn with Mr. Phillips. Mr. Phillips shorter than the other two, but much more muscular, in his zip-up windcheater. The young man in his navy blue blazer, the heavier older man from the agents in a well-worn grey suit, a country shirt, and an old-fashioned polka-dotted handkerchief stuffed into his breast pocket. They looked at the granary. They opened the garages or wagon sheds next to the granary. They opened the farmhouse and looked at that. They wandered away down the box-hedged enclosure, and a little while later reappeared. The young man in the blazer came in to see me. The older man went on with Mr. Phillips along the lane to the manor, past the overgrown yew hedge and the new openness where once the tree beeches had cast shade. Talking about the dereliction he had seen in the back garden, the young man said, "It's a cruel thing to say, but the best thing would be to cut down all the beeches and plant afresh." It was a cruel thing to say. It would do away with the place and setting I lived in. But the young man wasn't speaking with any great conviction or concern. His eyes were quite bright with pleasure. He had been slightly oppressed by being all morning in the company of his superior, the man in the grey suit, and now, in the cottage, he, younger than he looked from a distance, was oddly skittish and playful and relaxed. Not at all agent material, I would have thought. And it turned out very soon that his heart wasn't in the business. His comment about the trees was just something he had said, because, perhaps, he had heard it said in various circumstances by other people in the agency. As was his comment, looking at the paddock where the dairyman from the neighbouring farm had kept his pony, and where the once-famous old racehorse had come to die, "You could put a couple of beeves in there and fatten them up." A couple of beeves. Was that really his language? His style? It wasn't, and that self-awareness or self-knowledge lay so close to the surface of his thoughts that it required only the beginning of conversation to bring it out. His father was a gamekeeper on a proper estate not far away. Through the recommendation of his father's employer, he had been taken on for a trial period by the agency, and he had accepted the offer, this thin young man with a smiling, blank, unformed face, to please both his father and his father's employer. But his heart was elsewhere. He didn't know exactly where. He would have liked service life, would have dearly liked to be an officer, but some physical disability, and perhaps also some examination failure, had kept him out of that. He said, "You're never one of them." Them? Who were his them? The them he was concerned with turned out to be the other young men from the agents. At the end of the day, they simply went home. There was no question of going to a pub with them, or of them asking him home. And simply, in his skittish, restless, shallow way, he bared his personality in a few minutes. And there was almost nothing more he had to say when the big man in the grey suit came to call with Mr. Phillips. The young man in the blazer then stopped talking and continued to smile in his friendly, empty way. The big man sat down in my shabby armchair, and he seemed genuinely tired, genuinely happy to sit down, happy to sip the coffee he was offered. He tried to suggest that, without looking, he really was looking. But I didn't feel he was looking now. I felt he had seen enough already. He was puffy, a recent puffiness over a body that had once been sturdy and active. He was in his late 40s, his breathing was difficult, and his hair was thin and flat and lackluster. The polka-dotted handkerchief in his breast pocket was an odd touch of gaiety. He was not interested in me, my past, or what I did. He had ceased already to be interested in Mr. Phillips. He was already, though sitting in my armchair, far away with himself, his solitude. What could interest such a man? What kinds of things had once pricked his curiosity or caused him surprise? Perhaps now, he gave that impression, he was a little melancholy that active life had gone by so quickly already. Perhaps he had been moved by the dereliction of what he had seen in the manor and in the manor grounds. Perhaps it had chimed in with his own mood, reinforced that mood. He said, no doubt having been briefed by Mr. Phillips, "Nice spot for writing." I said, "It's nice, but I know it can't last." He said quietly, "No one can be certain of anything." And the words, though so ordinary, seemed to be spoken less to me than to himself, and about himself. All at once the inspection, if it had been that, was over. All three men left. They walked back to the manor along the lane between the cottage and the vegetable garden. The man in the grey suit walked heavily, carefully, making me aware of the hard lane with chippings of stone or heavy limestone beaten into the surface, with water-carried drifts of beech-mast and leaf debris in the ruts made by motor tyres. They walked past the hidden garden Pitten had some summers before spent a week clearing. Mr. Phillips, muscular and steady and already half-protective towards the heavy, breathless man in the grey suit on his left, and with a slender, frivolous, even slightly skipping gamekeeper's son in his blazer on the right. About half an hour or so later, before lunch, Mrs. Phillips came to see me. She was wearing her blue padded cardigan or jacket that bloated her and suggested someone wearing an emergency life jacket, as in an illustration in an airline card about emergency exits and what to do when the aircraft came down in water. The dark skin below her eyes, the darkness and pouches of her nerves, had lost some of its gathers and fussy lines, had lost even some of its darkness. Although she still had the manner of an invalid, someone who needed to be looked after, she had long ago begun to heal. Her hair had gone thin, had begun to go back from her forehead, giving her the high, white forehead of a lady in an Elizabethan painting. So there was in her face a mixture of coarseness and delicacy. She stood in the kitchen doorway, not coming in. Behind her, the stony lane, the abandoned cold frames, the vegetable garden wall with the tiled coping, and the blackthorns that had grown up in the past 5 years on both sides of the wall. Flourishing on the other, sunny side of the wall, rising above the wall, but thin and long-stalked on my side, the side I could see, growing in a poor corner and dragged up mainly by light, it seemed. Those blackthorn seedlings, the flowers and then the fruit, had worried the Phillipses. Though they had lived here, in the region, all their life, and Mr. Phillips's father had been born just a few miles away, their knowledge of country things was restricted. Far away,